Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
Tanzanian traditional healers have been using special plants, religious writings, and massages to treat the sick for generations. Now officials on the islands of Zanzibar want to register the healers in hopes of creating rules governing their methods. Leaders in Zanzibar passed the Traditional and Alternative Medicine Act, which called for registrations, in 2009. Since then, they have registered about 340 healers. Hassan Kombo is the government registrar at the council that keeps records of the healers. Kombo told the Reuters News Service there are an estimated 2,000 additional healers, known as Mgangas, hoping to register. Traditional healer B. Monahija Mze has already registered. The 56-year-old treats people at her busy clinic, where women line up in the early morning sun holding their sick children. One family recently sought treatment for a child suffering from an umbilical hernia. The family was worried that if the child was taken to a hospital for an operation to remove the hernia, he would die. A pregnant woman who had many failed pregnancies in the past came for support, medicine, and prayers that her baby would survive. "People come here because I actually help them. I met many patients that went to hospital first and got no help, or the medicine didn't work," said Wanahija Mze. "This is my job 6 days a week for more than 20 years, so I do better, no more than them. Patients that come to me don't die." Wanahija Mze's parents were also traditional healers in Zanzibar, a group of islands in the Indian Ocean. To be registered, Mgangas must be at least 18 years old, have at least 3 years of experience, and have a letter of support from a trained Mganga. A council of 11 members that can include birth attendants, respected healers, village elders, and legal experts approves the requests each month. Kombo explained that the government does not tell healers what treatments they can and cannot use, but it tries to work with them on issues like quality control, to ensure plants used in medicines are all of the same quality, for example. A group organized by the registrar's office links doctors with traditional healers to give them some medical education. The Mgangas share information about patients with the doctors, he said. Some healers use plants. Others use religious writings from the Muslim holy book, the Quran. Most use both. Belief in spirits like jinns is widespread. Some healers, like Haji Mrisho, mainly give blessings to pregnant women to prevent jinns from taking spiritual control of their unborn babies. Others, like sheikhs at the Shifa Herbal Clinic, read the Quran to remove jinns blamed for many diseases. Wanahija Mze uses a mix of massages, medicines from roots and other plant material, and readings from the Quran, which may be written on a plate in red food coloring. The plate is then cleaned with water, and the patients drink the water as part of the treatment. Some patients, like Fatma Hamad, said they trust traditional healers more than health workers in the overcrowded public hospitals, which have little financial support. Many people feel their illnesses are not treated correctly. Makunduchi Hospital is the second largest government-run hospital on Zanzibar's main island. Fatawi Haji Hafid heads the hospital. He says overworked doctors and other employees may not have the right equipment or time to see patients. Patients may also be unable to pay for medicine, or they may stop taking it before they are fully cured. This causes them to get sick again and adds to their distrust of government-run hospitals, he said. I'm Pete Musto.
Many African Americans are visiting Ghana because of its historic links to the slave trade across the Atlantic Ocean hundreds of years ago. A professional cook who goes by the name Chef Sage, which is not her real name, waits for the U.S. visitors in Ghana's capital. At her cafe in Accra, she cooks food influenced by her time in the United States, the Caribbean islands, and Ghana. The smell of spices float in the air while her loyal customers sit at tables outside. I had that southern influence, my grandmother with cornbread, the whole soul food works, and then also being in the Caribbean, having that Caribbean influence as well. I don't know if a lot of people living in Africa know that the foods in the Caribbean are so similar, Chef Sage said. She said that she is seeing more African American customers who are in Ghana for year of return activities. They are visiting to mark 400 years since the start of the transatlantic slave trade. The visitors sit with regular customers as Chef Sage and her family serve plant-based meals. Chef Sage was born in Brooklyn, New York, moved to St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands as a child, and moved to Ghana in 2005. Some African Americans do consider this our homeland, and we are happy to be here. But that food, you are still looking for what you are accustomed to. So I think I attract African Americans because I still have those flavors, Sage said. Chef Sage does private cooking in Accra in addition to her cafe. The food changes weekly and can include anything from sweet potato pie to tacos to salads, all made with local products. I'm Susan Shand.
Scientists blame greenhouse gases for being a major cause of climate change around the world. This is because greenhouse gases trap heat in the atmosphere and make the planet warmer. Higher temperatures have caused major environmental problems on Earth, scientific research shows. These problems include loss of sea ice, rising sea levels, loss of ocean life, and more intense weather events. Such problems are predicted to worsen unless governments around the world take action to reduce greenhouse gases. Carbon dioxide is one of the major greenhouse gases. Most of this heat-trapping gas is produced through human activities related to burning fossil fuels for electricity, heat, and transportation. Several major industries have attempted to move away from fossil fuels in favor of cleaner energy solutions. Now, a team of researchers has announced a successful experiment that turned carbon dioxide into useful liquid fuel. The research was led by scientists from Rice University in the United States and was supported by the U.S. Department of Energy. The findings were recently published in Nature Energy. The researchers created a device called a reactor that converts carbon dioxide into a pure form of formic acid. Formic acid is a substance found in ants and some other insects, as well as in many plants. It is used as an antibacterial material and in the processing of some kinds of clothing. Hao-Tien Wang led the research team. He is a biomolecular engineer at Rice University. He said in a statement that the results of the experiment were important because formic acid is a major carrier of energy. So, the substance can provide a way to reuse carbon dioxide and prevent it from being released into the atmosphere. It's a fuel cell fuel that can generate electricity and emit carbon dioxide, which you can grab and recycle again, Wang said. Other methods for turning carbon dioxide into formic acid require intense purification processes, Wang said. Such methods are very costly and require a lot of energy. The Rice University team said it was able to reduce the number of steps used in the traditional process to create a low-cost, energy-saving method. The researchers reported the reactor device performed with a conversion rate of 42%. This means that nearly half of the electrical energy can be stored in formic acid as liquid fuel. The team said the reactor was able to create formic acid continuously for 100 hours with little degradation of the device's parts. Wang said the reactor could easily be changed to produce other high-value products, including alcohol-based fuels. The researchers noted that the technology could also be a big help in solving another major energy problem, how to store large amounts of power in small places. Wang said formic acid can be used as a better storage material for hydrogen, for example. Hydrogen is seen as a possible new energy source to power automobiles and trains. Hydrogen combines with oxygen to produce electrical power and only releases water and steam into the atmosphere. The researchers said their findings suggest formic acid can hold nearly 1,000 times the energy as the same amount of hydrogen. Since hydrogen is difficult to shrink down and store, it currently presents a big challenge for hydrogen fuel cell cars, Wang said. He added that the team plans to keep working to improve the process. The team also aims to reduce the cost in hopes of bringing the technology to places around the world to help fight climate change. The big picture is that carbon dioxide reduction is very important for its effect on global warming, Wang said. If the electricity comes from renewable sources like the sun or wind, we can create a loop that turns carbon dioxide into something important without emitting more of it. I'm Brian Lin.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The Constitution became law once 9 of America's 13 original states ratified it. The Continental Congress set a date for the new plan of government to take effect, the first Wednesday in March of 1789. In 1789, the population of the United States was about 4 million. The 13 states had been loosely united for a short time, only about 10 years. Before that, they were separate colonies of Britain. Because the colonies were separate, they developed different ways of life, different economies, different traditions. Americans were fiercely independent, but the crisis of the American Revolution brought them together. Together, they celebrated the 4th of July, the day in 1776 when America declared its independence from Britain. Together, they fought British troops to make that declaration a political reality. And together they joined under the Latin phrase, a pluribus unum, one out of many. Yet they did not really consider themselves a national people. When the war ended, the soldiers returned to their home states. They still thought of themselves first as New Yorkers or Virginians or Marylanders. Americans of 1789 were sharply divided on the need for a national government. Many were afraid the new government would not survive. They feared the anarchy that would result if it failed. Others hoped it would fail. They wanted strong state governments, not a strong central government. Also in 1789, the American economy was improving after the destruction caused by the Revolutionary War. Agriculture, trade, and shipbuilding were coming back to life. Roads, bridges, and canals were being built. The country's economy still had many problems, however. Two major issues had to be settled. One was the repayment of loans made to support the Revolutionary Army. The other was the creation of a national monetary system. Both issues needed quick action. And before the new government could act, the old government still had work to do on other issues, like the question of a capital. At the time the states approved the Constitution, the Continental Congress was meeting in New York City. And that was where the Congress decided to place the new government. Later, the capital would be moved to Philadelphia for a while. Finally, it would be established in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. Next, members of the Continental Congress had to decide when the states would choose a president. They agreed to March 4, 1789, the same day the Constitution would go into effect. The states that ratified the Constitution chose electors to vote for a president. The result was not a surprise. They chose the hero of the Revolutionary War, George Washington. No one opposed the choice, except, perhaps, for George Washington himself. Here are actors having an imaginary conversation between James Madison and George Washington. Madison is trying to persuade Washington that he should be the new nation's first president.
Oh, sir, it must be you who serves as president. It is your influence that unites the states.
I can tell you honestly, I do not want the honor. I'm very much aware of my deficient education and the 10,000 embarrassments it will cause me in office. I would hope they could find a younger man. But I want nothing more but to return to Mount Vernon and tend to my farming.
But, sir, if your country should need you...
If called, I will serve.
Washington learned of his election while at Mount Vernon, his home in Virginia. He left for New York, where he was inaugurated on April 13th. Members of the new Congress were also elected on March 4th. One of the first things the Congress did was to reopen debate on the Constitution itself. Several states had set a condition for approving the document. They said a Bill of Rights listing the rights of all citizens must be added to the Constitution. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says one of the most important parts of the Bill of Rights is its source, the people.
In effect, it's crowdsourced, and we the people actually say, where are the rights? And we get this Bill of Rights because of that conversation.
To many Americans, the Bill of Rights represents the heart and soul of the Constitution. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has said that when he reads the document, he gets chills.
There was always this underlying belief that we were entitled to be a full participant in we the people.
Just what is this Bill of Rights, and what does it say? The Bill of Rights is the name for the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. The First Amendment deals with freedom of expression, including, as Justice Clarence Thomas points out, freedom of religion.
The First Amendment is what? Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. In other words, stay out of it and leave people alone when it comes to their religion.
The First Amendment guarantees that religion and government will be separate. Congress cannot establish an official religion or interfere in the people's right to worship as they choose. The First Amendment also protects other rights. Here is the full text. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. In other words, people have a right to gather peacefully and to make demands of the government. Constitutional law expert Akhil Reed Amar says the idea of free expression can be found throughout the Bill of Rights.
And even before there's the text of freedom of speech, there's the practice of freedom of speech. Five times the Bill of Rights uses the same phrase, the people, in the first, and the second, and the fourth, and the ninth, and the tenth amendments.
Mr. Amar says he believes the Bill of Rights says the people so often because the document comes from the people. The Second Amendment deals with guns. Here is what it says. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The Third Amendment says people may not be forced to let soldiers stay in their homes during peacetime. The next five amendments protect people's rights in the justice system. The Fourth Amendment protects people from unreasonable searches and seizures. It bars courts from approving warrants unless there is probable cause. And it says warrants should describe the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. The Fifth Amendment says people should not be tried for the most serious crimes unless a grand jury has first examined the evidence. It also bars people from being tried twice for the same offense. And it says the government cannot take people's property for public use without paying them a fair price. The Sixth Amendment says people accused of crimes have the right to a fair and speedy public trial by a jury. The aim is to guarantee that people are not kept in prison for a long time unless a jury has found them guilty of a crime. The Sixth Amendment also guarantees the right of the accused to be defended by a lawyer. It says they must be informed of the nature and cause of the charges against them. And it says they have the right to face and question their accusers. The Seventh Amendment guarantees the right to a jury trial in civil cases. The Eighth Amendment bars cruel and unusual punishments. The Ninth Amendment provides protection for other rights not stated directly in the Constitution. And the Tenth Amendment says any powers not delegated to the national government belong to the states or to the people. The exceptions are any powers that the Constitution prohibits states from having. So these first 10 amendments make up the Bill of Rights. Later, says law professor Akhil Reed Amar, more amendments were added to the Constitution.
As good as the founding was, the system kept getting better and better. We made amends for some of the flaws of the founders through a series of amendments, and that process continues today.
The Bill of Rights and the other changes that came later helped decrease the power of the federal government. Because these amendments limited the power of the federal government, many anti-federalists ended their opposition to the new government. Many agreed to help with the job of building the new nation. In all, 11 of the 13 states approved the Constitution before Washington was inaugurated as president. The last two states, North Carolina and Rhode Island, ratified it afterward. President Washington wanted the best men, Federalist or anti-Federalist, to be in his administration. The new nation needed strong leadership, and George Washington provided it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.